And displacement is a real issue. If you tear down vintage housing that was lower costing, that has something to do with pushing people out. We certainly saw that in Northeast Portland. The black community, traditional black community, was essentially pushed out to the numbers, as they say. And that was part of an engineered redevelopment movement, and it didn't work out for everyone.
Well, thank you. Did you want to say something to KBOO?
I'd be happy to. I've been involved in this movement for a little over a year after a house right next to me was torn down. And what I have learned by reading the city code is that there really is free range for this. And it's something that can be corrected if there's the political will to do so. And it has not been done. It's really a city council, and the mayor has paid lip service to it. For example, he was interviewed by the Portland Tribune in April of last year and promised to do something about demolitions right away. He saw it as a problem because there was a significant outpouring of emotion about the issue at a city council meeting. But he didn't do anything. And what happened was that he pushed it off to Amanda Fritz. They've talked about developing studies and task forces. The task forces are heavily development or developer representation. The representation on these committees are heavily tilted toward developers. And so there is really no incentive to do anything to change the law. And the things that need to be changed are very simple. Number one, and the most important thing that has been driving the acceleration in demolitions is the underlying historical or archaic lots. And when Portland was originally plotted out, lots were essentially drawn on a map where the streets were we have now today, and then the properties were drawn out essentially on a map. But those are not what the tax lots are that exist today. What actually was sold, what was actually built on, very often looked very different than what were on those original maps. So what a developer is able to do under city law currently is to go in and say, I want to re-enable these old archaic lot lines, and then I want to be able to divide my lot along that line. And so it would be a very simple change to the city charter to get rid of that. It would really stop the whole thing in its tracks. And if nothing else, if enough people believe that the right thing to do is that we really do need to study this and see what all the ramifications are, at the very least, there should be an emergency resolution to stop this now. Let's stop and look at it then and not use loopholes that are in the city code that are big enough to drive a double wide through. Let's stop this by having an emergency resolution, get rid of these archaic lines at least for a year or two, and take a look at it and intelligently then make a decision as to what the zoning in Portland should be.
And do you want to introduce yourself for KBOO?
I'm Bob Schlesinger, and I live in the East Moreland neighborhood.
Great. So you've got the struggle
and there's
going
a
web- there for the
And there's a website to learn more about this.
The sequoia trees are just going to in East Moreland.
Yes, yeah, the sequoias are in East Moreland. The city violated its own laws by granting a permit to cut those trees down. The city routinely violates its own laws.
Could the city be sued for that?
No one's done it yet. It takes money to sue the city. And in the case of the sequoias, the neighbors are trying to work with the developer to purchase the property, and they would rather go that route. And so that's their choice. But what's disturbing is that city officials and development services are really not following the law and granting permits where permits really should not be granted. I've done my own website on this issue called fixportlandzoning.com, and it's a good way to get started to learn about this, learn about what things in the law can and should be changed. And I think really that's my own personal angle that I'm pursuing to put pressure on the city council to do something serious about this rather than to just pay lip service to it.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Those were the voices of protesters standing on a street corner on southeast Portland, calling on the city to stop the demolition of so many old homes in the area. Coming up next, The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
Hey, you know, I got to tell you, being a former Fed, I really enjoy talking with our brothers and sisters with the American Federation of Government Employees, unsung heroes. Trust me, folks, they don't take the jobs for the money and the glory. There's darn sure too little of that. But, you know, it's important what our federal brothers and sisters do. To help me talk about this, we've got Rhonda Sapp. She's with the American Federation of Government Employees. She's council president for the U.S. Mint. Rhonda, welcome to Union Edge.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it. You know, people, they got money in their pocket, but a lot of times they don't think where that money came from. Talk to us a little bit about AFGE and the Council for the Mint.
Wow. AFGE and the Council for the Mint, first of all, let me say, they always confuse us with BEP, and we're not. We're the ones that make the change. But the Council is kind of awesome. The Mint is one of those unique agencies that, and so we're not appropriated, which is, it makes us operate a little differently. And it gives us flexibility. For example, we have a MCAP program, and that is the Manufacturing Apprenticeship Training Program. And what it does is it takes our blue-collar workers and it gives them skills that should they ever leave the federal space that they can take it with them, such as the electricians and the metal forming machine operators and things like that. And it also gives them, as a part of the agency, an opportunity to sort of move up in terms of grade and pay. And it was one of those things that we were actually able to partner with the agency with. It took us a long time between OPM and the Department of Labor to kind of bless these things so that we came to the table, the agency came to the table, and they said, well, we want this and we need that. And we said, okay, we'll gladly give it to you, but hey, our people need to be paid. They need to be able to walk away with some type of marketable skill.
Right.
And it took us a while, I'll say maybe a couple of years, and part of it was before my tenure, but at any rate, it's one of those successful programs where these people have true opportunities to kind of grow. They've acquired new skill sets that they ordinarily would not have gotten. And what we did was we initially started out with Philadelphia and Denver that were our circulating coin plants. And then we kind of graduated over to San Francisco and West Point, which are the places that handles our precious metals. So it was sort of like a mobility program for everybody. So it's a pretty exciting program. And most people love it. It's voluntary, but you know, we have a waiting list. That's how much people like it. So it's a really good program.
Rhonda, you guys brought you and AFGE in conjunction with management at the Mint, brought this together through partnership?
Yes.
Could you explain to us what partnership is? Because that's it's a very important concept. It's a very important way of working. But I don't think a lot of our non-governmental union folks quite understand what that is.
Basically, what partnership means in the federal space is that both sides will look at what are our mutual interests, what is the end game, what's the goal. So we'll decide together, collectively, what that is. And rather than to take positions as us union folk always have a tendency to do, and as management always have a tendency to do, we found that mutual goal and we collaborated and talked about it. And we didn't take a lot of the formal bargaining positions that you would normally take to reach whatever that interest was. I know, I think during the Clinton era, I believe that partnership became, and then it later change the collaboration. I can't remember
right.
which president it was, but basically what it means is rather than to just always come to the table to bargain, let's see what our mutual goals are. What is it? What's in the deal for both sides?
Right.
And we talk about it and we work it out. And then that way you don't have some of those formal processes that will sometimes cause goals and achievements for employees to get lost.
Right, exactly. And the really neat thing about this is this is pre-decisional. This is before the programs are implemented, before the programs are designed. Everybody gets together. The management team gets together with the subject matter experts, the people actually doing the job. And they say, hey, you know, we want to do this. How do we get it done? What's the best way to do it? What are your thoughts? And then the rank and file team comes back and says, hey, this is what we think is the best way to do this. We know that we can, you know, I'm going to steal from NASA. We can do it better, faster, or cheaper if we do it this way. What do you think? And then back and forth, it gets a blessing from the legal department. And then, hey, you got an agreement that there was no, you know, no bristling fur. It's a wonderful
thing.
Exactly. It is. And, you know, this is really neat because you guys basically have put together a building trades apprenticeship program within the Mint. People get the skills. They get the training. They get the pay boost. The skills are portable. And it's a wonderful thing all the way around.
It is. And the other thing that I will share is with us, sort of perfecting that process, we've been able to take that and apply it to other things. We are actually now working on and having conversations about a program so that we can take that and translate it to some of the GS employees who are kind of stuck in these lower graded positions who have a tendency to always get other duties as assigned, but we all mm-hmm. know that it's another job and it has a higher pay potential. So we've taken that method and applied it across the board to a lot of other things from the pre-decisional, let's talk first for that. And I will say this, which was kind of surprising to me, our treasurer, Rosie Rios, sort of emphasizes to management that people should come first, and I think that goes a long way in us being able to come and say, hey, agency, let's talk about this. We don't have to go straight into bargaining, and it's not saying that we're giving up that right, but at least let's come and talk about it, and let's see those things that we've done in the past, those processes that we've done, and let's redo them again. Let's apply it that way so that we're giving more to our employees because we believe that people should be first, and we're sort of giving back to the American public and saying, hey, we're not tied down in these things. We're getting the best bang for our buck, and it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Absolutely. And Rhonda, congratulations on that. Rhonda, listen, we're up against a hard deadline. I get a transition in, but very quickly, how do we find out more about you, and your counsel?
Well, we haven't unfortunately gotten our website up, but my email is rosapp, R-H-O-S-A-P-P, @gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And I will gladly share any information that anyone would have or any questions that they would want to have about our council.
Well, there you go. And if there's anything at all we can do to help, please don't hesitate. In the meantime, Rhonda, we've got to go. Rhonda Sapp of American Federation of Government Employees, Council 157. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio. You know, folks, every once in a while, when, you know, you've got a group of friends here and a group of friends there, and each one of these groups of friends kind of come up with the same idea that's probably really neat. But you come up with it completely in a vacuum, separately from each other, makes you go, And my friend Craig Harrington of Media Matters and I were just talking about some very interesting things. And I think, Craig, you guys are coming up with it. We're coming up with it here. It's going to be interesting. We'll talk about that later. But Rush Limbaugh's attacking the Pope again.
Yes. This is something that we've seen a lot of since Pope Francis became the sort of supreme pontiff of the universal Christian Church. Right-wingers like Rush Limbaugh, many Fox News personalities, conservative pundits like George Will, Charles Krauthammer, have variously come out against Pope Francis at different times for positions that he takes that they consider too liberal. And what we saw on July 10th, so last Friday on Rush Limbaugh's show, is Limbaugh went into this five-minute tirade attacking the Pope and calling him a clown, essentially, for criticizing what the Pope called unfettered capitalism. On July 9th, Pope Francis was addressing a crowd in Bolivia, and he said that unbridled capitalism is the, quote, dung of the devil, something that that fosters and encourages and allows inequality to thrive. And, of course, inequality and suffering, these are things that the Pope, as the pontiff of the Catholic Church, he wants to, you know, make the world a better place for his billion followers and for the billions more who live on this planet and share it with him. He's always been a crusader against inequality. It's always been something he cares about. And the fact that he cares about it just enrages the right wing. But people like even Rush Limbaugh used to speak out against unfettered and unbridled capitalism back when it was in vogue with the conservative right wing. But now that it's something that is considered more liberal, and now that the sides have sort of figured out where they land on these things, the Pope gets criticized. But, you know, nobody's looking to Rush Limbaugh for religious conviction or for some sort of concept of morality. The Pope is a figure who matters in the lives of hundreds of millions of people worldwide, and I guess they just can't stand that when he speaks out against about things, they can't stand when he comes down on the side where President Obama or Bill and Hillary Clinton or Democrats happen to be. Anytime he says something that agrees with the politics of the Democratic Party, they come out and attack him.